All right. It's been a little while since we've had lecture, and I want to apologize. We're behind schedule, quite a bit behind schedule. So I want to try to catch up if at all possible. Of course, we're moving away from our discussion of utilitarianism toward a discussion of Kantianism, and I think it'll become clear immediately that Kant and Kantianism are, well, at least on the surface of things, the positions, the views, are very different. They're motivated by, you know, different conceptions of what the good life happens to be. They're also motivated by different reasons to, you know, in the way that they think about how we should arrive at discerning whether our actions are right or wrong. Of course, for Kant, you'll soon see that motivation plays a much larger role in discerning whether our actions are right or wrong than it does for utilitarianism. Let me say one thing about Kantianism before I begin, however, and this will seem rather counterintuitive perhaps to some of you, but what we have to understand is that Kantianism is not necessarily congruent with what Kant said about Kantianism. Right? Unfortunately, we don't have a name for, you know, what it was that Kant was up to. But what we want to say is that Kantianism has sort of taken on a life of its own after Kant. And so even though Kant believed things about his theory, believed that there were certain implications that could be withdrawn from his theory, not everything that Kant believed followed from his theory actually does follow from his theory. In other words, Kant may have misapplied or misinterpreted the implications of his own theory, right? And so while we, you know, while generally speaking, we agree with, you know, the way that Kant goes about arriving at various moral conclusions, we're not so concerned with what he actually has to say about, you know, particular moral dilemmas. Right? For instance, Kant himself, right, Immanuel Kant, the dead guy, thinks that lying is never morally permissible. As you know, you've read On the Supposed Right to Lie from Philanthropy. Now, of course, if you've read that piece carefully and you've written a reading response, you know that, you know, Kant says there are absolutely no exceptions. Lying is always morally forbidden. Now, you know, the strange thing about that that conclusion is that Kant really never uses his apparatus that he, you know, that he lays out in the Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, which is the book that you're now reading. In the Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, Kant lays out, you know, his philosophy, his, you know, the system, his moral system that will allow him to derive all of common sense morality. And the strange thing is that he never uses that system in order to arrive at the conclusion that lying is never morally permissible. Kant, in The Supposed Right to Lie from Philanthropy, just sort of assumes that that's what will follow from his philosophy. And he never does demonstrate that. So, that's just one example of how, you know, Kant seems to have misunderstood the implications of his own theory. And so, on the one hand, we're happy with Kant. We're glad that he's given us this way of thinking about morality. But on the other, we're not always pleased with the way he interprets his own theory. So there's something different about Kant himself and his opinions about his moral philosophy and what we might call Kantianism, right? And so because we're not really concerned with what Kant believes about morality, rather we're concerned with what, you know, what is reasonable to believe about morality, we're going to use Kant's apparatus, right, what he lays out in the Groundwork, and we're going to you know, see if it's really true that, you know, what Kant had to say about the implications of his theory. And you know, most of the time what Kant has to say will be rather intuitive, but there will be occasions where we reach, or we may reach, conclusions that are out of harmony with what Kant has to say in some instances. Okay, so where do we go from here? Well, to begin with, what we need to talk about is why we might be attracted to Kantianism as opposed to utilitarianism. Now, we saw that when we were considering the utilitarian doctrine, that two major problems sort of surfaced, and those problems were the problem of permitting too much, right? We felt that perhaps that the utilitarian principle was too permissive. It allowed me to kill Darcy, for example. But beyond that, it was also a very demanding theory, right? So we have the problem of permitting too much and the problem of demanding too much. You know, and so, believe it or not, there have been various ways of trying to answer those problems, and whether or not those answers are successful is not something that we're going to discuss in any length now. But if you believe that those two problems make it such that you could never become a utilitarian, or, you know, you're not very impressed with utilitarianism after considering those problems, you may want to consider Kantianism as an alternative. Right. Well, let me introduce a couple terms that Kant uses. He wants to make a distinction between what's called heteronymous, heteronymous accounts of morality, as opposed to autonomous accounts of morality. Right? Heteronymous basically means outside. You might be familiar with the prefix hetero, which, you know, when you talk about heterosexual, you're talking about someone who's attracted to someone of the opposite sex. When you talk about heteronomy, you're talking about a law, right? Nomos is law, and hetero, it means other or different, right? So heteronomos means the law that comes from something different, or the law that comes from outside of you. As opposed to autonomous, again, you have the same nomos, but now you have autonomos, right? So autonomous, literally translated, would mean, you know, self-law, or, you know, the law that comes from within. Now, Kant thinks that morality has gone wrong up until he came around, which is an always interesting psychological observation of philosophers, especially of the period in which Kant was prominent. You know, many philosophers thought that, you know, they were putting an end to philosophy once people rightly understood them, that you know, philosophy would be done with. And, you know, Kant was no exception to that general rule. At any rate, so we're talking about heteronomy and autonomy, and Kant thinks the history of philosophy has been riddled with heteronomous accounts of the moral life. And what he believes is that morality won't work. It won't work well if we continue to emphasize a heteronomous moral philosophy. Rather, he proposes that we ought to think about morality as proceeding from the principle of autonomy. So autonomy, again, is about self-law. And we'll return to the concept of autonomy a little bit later, to give you a more full account of what he has in mind. But basically, Kant wants to say, look, if you want to avoid the consequences of utilitarianism, right, if you want to avoid the problems of demanding too much and the problems of problem of permitting too much, you've got to start with completely different principles, right? You have to have an entirely different basis for morality. So, Kant begins with, you know, the groundwork of the metaphysics of morals. He uses that word, the groundwork, or in another translation, it's called the foundation of the metaphysics of morals, right? Kant wants to begin with an entirely different foundation. He has an entirely different foundational account of what the principles of morality should be. Unfortunately, in the groundwork, he doesn't spell this out in a very simple fashion. Kant works backwards, like a process of discovery. What he wants to say is that, look, if we presuppose morality, if we just talk about morality, what is it that we all presuppose. In other words, if we can trust, if the principles of morality are valid or legitimate, what must be presupposed in order for the principles of morality to be legitimate at all, right? So in other words, let me say it one last, this may be a tricky for you to understand, but basically what Kant is saying is, look, what is it that has to be taken for granted for morality to work at all? Now, we believe certain things about the moral life, and in order for those things that we believe about the moral life to make any sense, there has to be something undergirding them. Okay? And Kant thinks that needs to be elucidated before we can go forward. Okay. All right. So, what is it? What is the principle, the foundation of morality, or the groundwork of morality? Well, Kant thinks it's freedom. Okay? Freedom is the basis of morality. Without freedom, there could be no morality. In other words, if it turns out that human beings are not free, and we haven't yet stipulated the sense in which we are free, if we are at all, but Kant is concerned about a particular kind of freedom, and if it turns out that we're not free, then Kant thinks morality will be an illusion. Right. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, he seems to mean something like this. Think about when somebody offends you in a particular way. Imagine that you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend or husband or wife, and they cheat on you. Right? They commit adultery, or they just become interested in another person, and they cheat on you. What's the first thing that you're going to wonder or ask that person? Well, you might say, why did you do that? Why did you do that? And then, of course, you're going to hold them accountable for what they did, right? You're going to want to, punish them in some sense, if that were possible. I'm using the word punish in a broad sense, but certainly, you'd be upset, and you'd hold them accountable. You'd blame them for their behavior. Well, think about what it means to blame someone, and how is it possible that you could blame someone? Blaming seems to imply that the person you're blaming could have done something other than what they actually did, right? If you have a husband that's cheated on you, the whole idea is that when you blame them for their behavior, you're presupposing that they could have decided not to cheat on you, right? In fact, blaming hardly makes any sense at all, unless it's possible for someone to not do what they did, right? My daughter often leaves the milk out on the counter. Right? She'll get her cereal in the morning, and then, I come home, after work in the late afternoon, and what do I see? There's milk on the counter, and I say, Elizabeth, why did you leave the milk on the counter, right? And in a sense, I'm blaming her for leaving the milk on the counter. And the question is, does that make any sense if it's not possible for Elizabeth to do anything else? Right? In other words, if it's somehow necessitated that she leaves the milk on the counter, then my blaming her for leaving the milk on the counter makes no sense at all. Right? And this is what Kant is pointing to. He wants to say that we can't blame people for things they have no control over. And that makes a lot of intuitive sense to most of us. So the principle or the basis of morality is freedom. Right? And morality is about holding people accountable. It's about requiring certain types of behaviors from people. Right? There are moral obligations that we ought to meet. And if we fail to meet those obligations, then Kant thinks we are blameworthy. Right? And when we do meet those obligations, we want to say that your actions are praiseworthy, right? And so again, there's a sort of symmetry here. Whatever we say about blame, we can also say about praise, right? Praising someone for something they have no control over makes very little sense, although we tend to do that more often, right? We praise people for being good-looking, for example, when being good-looking really doesn't have anything to do with anything they have control over, right? So there is a kind of asymmetry, although perhaps there shouldn't be. All right, so what are we talking about then? Well, we're talking about freedom, and Kant thinks freedom is the basis of morality. Without freedom, there could be no morality at all. Right? Morality would end up being something like an illusion. Okay, well, what does that mean for us? Well, what we need to do then is talk about what exactly Kant means by freedom. Well, there are lots of different kinds of freedom and lots of different ways of talking about freedom. Certainly we enjoy political freedoms in the United States, in Canada, and Europe, and all over the world, right? There are forms of political freedom. In some places there is very little political freedom. if I were to be incarcerated, right, and sent to prison, in a sense I would no longer be free. But in another sense, I would retain my freedom, right? There are certain freedoms that I would retain even in prison, right? if I were sent to, maybe Pakistan or certain regions in Pakistan, northern Pakistan or Afghanistan, and I was under a strict Taliban regime, right? There are certain political freedoms that I wouldn't be able to enjoy, right? But there are other freedoms that no one could take away from me, no matter how devastating or how all-encompassing any kind of political regime might be. Right? So freedom is tricky, and we're not exactly sure yet what Kant has in mind about freedom. So we need to get clear on that. All right. So what does Kant mean by freedom? Well, when Kant talks about freedom, he's really talking about rationality of a particular kind. Right? Now, he breaks reason, and when I say reason and rationality, I'm talking essentially about the same thing, right? I'll use those words almost interchangeably. Reason or rationality. To be reasonable is to be rational. To be rational is to be reasonable. Right? So when Kant talks about freedom, he's talking about a form of rationality. And what he does, he wrote a very large book called The Critique of Pure Reason, where he examined, you know, reason in its theoretical domain, right? Rather than its practical domain. He writes another book called The Critique of Practical Reason, where he explores in greater detail the findings of the groundwork of the metaphysics of morals, right? You're reading the groundwork of the metaphysics of morals. We could have read the Critique of Practical Reason, which is another book that he wrote, following up on what he had previously said in the groundwork. However, back to the Critique of Pure Reason. In the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant is talking about the limits of rationality, right, and what it's appropriate to talk about, what it's appropriate to think about, what it's appropriate to claim knowledge of, right? And so he's talking about reason in its theoretical domain. In the Critique of Practical Reason, he's talking about reason in its practical domain. Right? So he wants to talk about reason in both of its applications, right? Reason has a theoretical application, but it also has a practical application, right? And so we can talk about reason in our beliefs, right? And when we talk about what it's appropriate to believe, what is reasonable to believe, we're talking about reason in its theoretical deployment. When we talk about reason in the practical domain, we're talking about conduct, right? What is reasonable to do? What is reasonable? How should I live, right? How is it, or what's the most reasonable way to live? What is the most reasonable way to behave? And so we're talking about, again, the theoretical domain where we're concerned with beliefs, on the other hand, we're talking about the practical domain where the essential concern is conduct or behavior or even desires, right? What is it reasonable to desire? And so that's how we'll proceed over the next couple of minutes. What I want to do then is talk about reason in its theoretical deployment first. Notice that whenever we believe something, it's possible for us to reevaluate and to modify our beliefs if we determine that our beliefs are unreasonable, right? Imagine that you believe, I don't know, that the moon is made of green cheese. And you hold this belief, and you believe it with all your might, right? And then it comes clear to you after, I don't know, some sustained research that it's unreasonable for you to believe that the moon is made of green cheese. It would be very easy for you, once that evidence was provided, to change your mind. Right? In fact, we change our minds all of the time. Right? In fact, I guess that's what education is all about. Right? It's about changing our minds about certain beliefs, right? Shaping our beliefs. So, in the theoretical domain, it's very easy for us to change what we believe. And this is the feature of this is seems to be what's going on, right? We take our beliefs, right? Whatever our beliefs happen to be about, and we hold them up. excuse me, we hold them up to certain standards, and we try to determine whether these standards are good standards, right? And that's another question. Let's leave that aside for the time being. But let's just think about the belief that we have, right? I take this belief, right? Imagine I could hold my belief in my hand. I have my belief in my hand, and what I want to do is determine whether this belief is a good belief or not, right? I want to know whether it's rational, whether it's reasonable for me to believe what I believe. So how would I determine that? Well, I would hold that belief up to certain standards of rationality. I might want to ask a question like this. Is my belief logically coherent, right? That's one test to determine whether a belief is reasonable. Certainly, if my beliefs are logically incoherent, they wouldn't be worthy of belief, right? Meaning that if my beliefs were logically contradictory, then they wouldn't make any sense, right? Wouldn't make sense to believe those things. That's one test. But there are other tests, right? Logical consistency is not a very comprehensive test, right? Lots of things are logically consistent and still not worthy of belief. Just because something is logically consistent doesn't mean we ought to believe it. But that's still one test, right? And of course, we could say that logical consistency is a necessary but insufficient reason for belief. Right? So, what do we want to say then? So that's one test. What else? Well, we could develop any kind of methodology to determine whether our beliefs are true or false, right? Maybe we could appeal to the principles of science, right? Do my beliefs hold up to the principles of science? And if they do, then they're worthy of belief. If they're not, if they don't hold up to the principles of science, then they're not worthy of belief, right? So there we have it. And we have any number of ways of determining whether our beliefs are true or false, right? But the point here is that I am capable of consciously reflecting upon my beliefs to determine whether those beliefs are true or false, right? And what I'm doing essentially is holding my beliefs up to a certain standard of rationality, and if my beliefs meet the standards of rationality, then we want to say that our beliefs are worthy of belief. Okay. And notice that if they are not worthy of belief, we can quickly reject them, right? We discard beliefs that are false, right? When we determine that something is false, we no longer believe it and we move on, right? Or we replace it with some other belief that's more worthy of belief, right? Or true. Okay, so if that happens to be the case, right? If what Kant says about reason in its theoretical deployment is true, he believes that we can transfer our discoveries in the theoretical domain to the practical domain. And we can talk about reason in its practical deployment. Right? And so what would it mean to be free in the practical sphere? Right? So, I mean, going back to that discussion, right? The freedom in the practical domain, or sorry, freedom in the theoretical domain has to do with this ability to think critically about my beliefs and to modify my beliefs if they fail to meet the standards of rationality. The same will be true in the practical sphere. I will be capable of thinking critically about not my beliefs, but my desires now. Right? Is it reasonable for me to desire what I desire? Right? And so, just as I, took up my belief in my hand, and try to determine whether it made sense for me to believe what I believed, so I can do the same thing in the practical sphere. Right? I can take my desires and think about them critically, right, and try to evaluate them over against some standard of rationality. Right? And I try to determine whether it's reasonable for me to desire what I desire. And of course, that's what Kant means by freedom in the practical sphere. If I lack the capacity to think critically about what I desire, and in addition, if I lack the ability to modify my desires, then Kant wants to say I'm not free in the practical sphere. So freedom in the practical sphere has to do with the capacity to evaluate, to think critically about my actions, plans, desires, my intentions, and to modify my actions, plans, desires, and intentions if they fail to meet the standards of rationality. So what's important is that I can modify my desires if I determine that my desires are stupid. Right? Now, it's important that we realize that we don't have to be perfectly rational in either the theoretical or the practical sphere. Right? To say that human beings sometimes believe things that are false, sometimes believe things that they shouldn't, is not to say that they're not capable of believing things that they should. Right? And the same is true in the practical sphere. To say that human beings sometimes do things that are stupid, or desire things that are stupid, is not to say they're incapable of desiring things that they should. Right? So it's always important to keep that in mind. Kant doesn't believe that we're perfectly rational. What he believes is that we're capable of being perfectly rational. Not that we're always perfectly rational, but we have the capacity to do so. Okay. All right, so I want to talk about something called an ought, right? O-U-G-H-T, right? Ought. What ought I to do? Now, there's a very important principle that you'll see in Kant as you read. He wants to say that ought implies can. Whenever there is a moral ought present, right? Whenever I ought to do something, Kant believes that I can do it, right? Ought implies can. If I ought to, then I can. In other words, if I ought to do something, I have the capacity to do it, right? In other words, it makes no sense to say that there is a moral imperative in place, right? It makes no sense to say I ought to do something if I am unable to do that thing, right? And that's, again, the feature that Kant is after, right? Kant wants to say, look, if we're not free, then I can have no obligation, right? If I'm not free, morality will make no sense. Morality can't ask me to do anything if it turns out that I'm not free. Ought implies can. Okay. Well, what do I want to say now? Let's think about what I've just said about reason in its practical deployment, since that's really what we're concerned with, right? We're not going to return to reason and its theoretical deployment again. Well, we will later, perhaps, but not for the time being. We're more concerned about reason in its practical deployment, and I want to further contrast what I've said with what we might say about an animal, a dog, for example. I have a dog. His name is Oscar. He's a Weimaraner, and he's a great dog, right? 5 years old. He just turned 5 a couple days ago. So what do we want to say about Oscar? Well, think about what reason is. And is it possible for animals to be reasonable? Now, it's important that you understand what I'm asking. I'm not asking whether or not animals display high degrees of intelligence. Certainly they do. But are animals rational in the sense in which Kant is concerned? Is it possible for animals to think critically about their desires and to modify their desires if they fail to meet the standards of rationality? And when we ask the question that way, it seems that Kant is right to say that animals are not rational in the sense in which he stipulated. They lack the capacity to hold their desires up to certain standards of rationality. In other words, Oscar certainly has desires, and he certainly has beliefs, right? For example, Oscar believes that ham tastes good, and he also wants to, or desires to, eat ham. Right? There's ham on the table. He knows it tastes good. He knows it smells good. Right, that's a belief. And he also wants to eat the ham. So those are desires and beliefs, right? Now, is it possible for Oscar to think critically, right, about his desires and beliefs? Or does it make more sense to think about Oscar as being bossed around by his desires and beliefs? And as far as Kant's concerned, it's the latter. Oscar is just sort of bossed around by his desires and beliefs. He can never think critically about what he believes or what he desires. He's just sort of ruled by his passions, right? And as far as I'm concerned, I think that's probably right, right? What distinguishes human beings from animals? Well, it's this capacity to think critically about what we desire and what we believe, and to modify our desires and beliefs over against some standard, right? The standards of rationality in this case. So dogs, cats, I don't know, lots of animals. You might even say the whole animal kingdom. What is it that distinguishes the animal kingdom from the human domain? Of course, we're also animals, but we're rational animals, right? We are somehow distinct from the animal world in that we're capable of reflecting upon what is required by duty, right? And that's really what distinguishes animals from us. Animals are not moral beings, right? They don't think of themselves as having moral obligations, whereas human beings do think of themselves as having moral obligations, right? And the source of that, the source of those obligations, according to Kant, is reason. Alright, so what do we want to say? Well, reason, you remember when I introduced the word autonomy, right? What Kant wants to say is that reason is autonomous, which is just another way of saying that human beings are free, right? Human beings are capable of self-legislation. Reason gives itself its own laws, right? This is what it means to be autonomous, to be self-legislating, right? Autonomos means to give oneself the law, right? And so Kant has this sort of idea that the moral law really comes from within. It's not something that, you're going to go out into the jungle and find, or it's not something that's going to proceed from the results, right? Remember that for utilitarians, Mill has this sort of a theory about how the rules of morality would have emerged. He seems to think that, from observed history, from my own life, and from the history of civilization, we've learned what kinds of behaviors tend to produce bad results. We've also learned what behaviors tend to produce good results. And from those observations, the rules of morality arise. Well, Kant thinks that's silly. The rules of morality don't arise that way, right? That would be to think about morality heteronomously. But if we think about morality autonomously, what we're going to see is that the rules of morality come from within us, right? Which means that they're a matter of reason, right? It's a matter of what is rational to do, what is rational, what is the best way to behave as a matter of pure reason. Okay. All right, so what do we want to say now? Let me just say again that, animals seem to lack that capacity, right? Animals are not self-legislating. They cannot reflect critically about what they desire, nor can they change their desires. sometimes human beings talk like this as well, right? Sometimes human beings want to say that we're much more like animals than we actually are. As far as Kant was concerned, we're nothing like animals, right? In the sense that, of course, we can behave like animals, which would be to, not obey the dictates of reason, in which case we're sort of giving in to our inclinations or giving in to our passions or desires, right? So we might say this, right? You've often heard people say, well, I was simply overwhelmed by desire, or, there are crimes of passion, for example, right? If a husband walks in on his wife committing adultery and he kills her and the man that's with her, he might get a reduced sentence, right? A crime of passion. I think in legal talk. There's a distinction between first and second degree murder. First degree murder is premeditated, right? Meaning that you are planning a murder. Second degree murder, of course, is a crime of passion, right? Meaning there was no prior thought. It was a crime that proceeded from the passions. Well, Kant thinks that this kind of talk, to be overwhelmed by desire, he thinks that's nonsense, right? It's not. Human beings are never overwhelmed by desire, right? Or overcome by desire. Rather, human beings succumb to desire, right? So, if a spouse or a girlfriend or boyfriend says, I couldn't help it, the girl was so beautiful, I just had to kiss her. Kant is going to say that's nonsense. It's bullshit, right? You never are overcome by desire. You simply succumb to desire, and that's the main distinction. Human beings are always capable of being in control. Not that they always are in control, but they're certainly capable of being in control. Now, let me say one last thing about heteronomy, right? The reason Kant prefers autonomy to heteronomy is that he believes heteronomy will always lead to consequentialism, right? We can't get what we want. In other words, we can't avoid the problem of demanding too much and the problem of permitting too much if we go with consequentialism, which is why we need to avoid heteronomy. So Kant believes we've got to go with autonomy as the basis of the moral life. Okay, so we'll end here and we'll pick up things from here next time.